Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. My next guest is also an author, Richard Conrath. Recently self-published his first book as a crime novel set in Florida called Cooper's Moon. It tells the story of a college professor turned homicide detective who finds his way into the world of human trafficking of children. For the rest of the hour, we're going to explore the writing process with him, but also the world of self-publishing, which has changed in recent years. What was once considered an outlier in the publishing world, think the term vanity press, it's evolved to become a way for authors to maintain control over their content, process, and distribution. As technology has made it easier to both print and disseminate written works, more and more authors are choosing the self-publishing route to get their words in the hands of people around the world. So, Richard, I want to thank you for coming in and being with us today.
Thank you, Julie. Delighted.
If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So first, let's start with a little bit of history on you. I understand you were once a Catholic priest. Can you give me a sense of the route that you took from there to here?
That's a great question. It's one that, of course, most people don't know about. In terms of my own personal life, my mother, who, God rest her soul, who is now deceased, would probably turn over in her grave if I were talking about being a former Catholic priest. But yes, I began at age 14, that would be middle school, junior high school, and went all the way through till I was 25, was ordained a Catholic priest. So I was one of the what we call lifers.
Mm-hmm.
In the,
it was an early decision.
Seminary. Oh, that was an early decision.
But then you've added to that journalist, college professor, college president twice, and you also lived in Turkey. So you've done a little living in there. So tell me this trajectory.
Yeah, journalist. I left the seminary, didn't know what to do when you leave the priesthood, I should say, not the seminary. I was in for 3 years, so I wanted to be a lawyer. I thought that's going to take too long. Became a teacher. And wrote as a freelance journalist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Sunday Magazine, and did some freelance writing for other papers as well up there. Well, I taught philosophy for about 15 years, Julie, and then decided that I was going to work on a PhD in philosophy until I learned that there aren't many jobs out there for philosophers. People don't necessarily want to know what's the meaning of life and pay you for it.
Yeah.
So I then went into administration, got my PhD at Chaos U, we call it, Kent State University, during the riots.
Was inspiring.
Wow. Yeah, I was in the journalism building during the riots where the students left. And my dissertation dealt with the student riots generally.
Did that have kind of an impact on you as a journalist going in going forward?
Oh, it did. One of my articles in the Plain Dealer dealt with student riots, and an article I wrote was entitled, Where Have All the Values Gone? And I felt very disappointed in the fact that they tore down some buildings there. But they did erect a shrine at Kent State University that I'm eternally grateful for.
So, and then you were a college president after you went into administration.
Yes, I was. I was a vice president of a college in Michigan and then became a president of a technical college, which later became a community college, and then moved to North Carolina to become president of Cape Scary Community College, excuse me, Wilmington residents. I say that in jest, Cape Fear Community College, where the movie Cape Fear is made.
Uh-huh.
And from there, my wife said, it's time for me to do something. So we decided to go overseas, and we went to Turkey, and I became the head of an American school in Tarsus, Turkey, which is right around the corner from Syria, and was there for 3 years.
So I bet that gives you an interesting perspective with what's going on currently in Syria, having lived fairly close.
Yes, it does. I wanted to go there for a while and visit, but my board suggested that would be too dangerous, so we didn't do
that. When was
this,
these 3 years?
This was 1993 to 1996.
Okay, it was getting tense already.
It was getting tense. We never thought it was dangerous until I came out of the consulate one time in Adana, a large city in southern Turkey, and saw two of the cops from Incirlik, we call them cops. One was the head of internal security for the American base there at Incirlik. Mm-hmm. Americans call it Incirlik. And the other was external security. They were under their car. And I don't generally see people lying under their cars when I walk out of a building. And I said, "Why? What are you doing?" And they said, "We're looking for bombs."
Yeah.
I said, "Gee, bombs. Do I need to look for bombs?" And he said, what kind of a car do you have? And I was parked right behind him. I said, this Ford. He said, oh, yeah, you need to look for bombs. And I said, what do they look like? Well, look for little wires and things like that. Well, I didn't do that because how would I know one wire from another? There are lots of wires in cars.
Yeah, you didn't get the MacGyver degree, did you?
No, I
didn't know what to do with that.
I didn't really.
So then how did you end up getting back to Southwest Florida?
Well, that was an interesting story. I left Turkey. I had an opportunity to go to some other headmaster positions in the Ukraine and in Mexico, but elected to come back here. I'd been away from my family, my relatives, my mother for a long time. And so we came back to Wilmington, North Carolina, and then began to explore Orlando, Turkey. And I remember that we had our I said, I want my furniture shipped back to Jacksonville. I meant Jacksonville, North Carolina, so we could move back to Wilmington. And after about a month, I called Turkey and I said, you know, the furniture is not here. It's not in Jacksonville. I said, oh, yes, it's in Jacksonville. I said, Jacksonville, North Carolina. No, Jacksonville, Florida. So that's how we wound up in Florida.
So you just followed your furniture.
Furniture was here.
Well, furniture is important. You need that. That's a big investment, having to refurnish everything. So yes. When in the process of all of this did you start writing Cooper's Moon?
Well, it was in the dark nights in Turkey, not dark in the sense of sad or melancholy, but rather there wasn't much to do there at night. The television was all in Turkish, and Tarsus is a little Turkish village with donkey carts fighting for purchase on the streets with Mercedes-Benzes and BMWs. And so my wife said, why don't you write some things and then read them to us as kind of entertainment? And I did. I started writing the first version of Cooper's Moon 24 years ago. And I would read it, and my wife, I'd look at my wife's face and she'd say, oh, no. And my son would laugh because it was originally a horror uh-huh. novel. Julie.
But your son would laugh.
He would laugh. I said, no, this is
not quite.
Good.
It's horrifyingly funny.
Well, it was a horrible. And it kept morphing until we finally got back to this country where I didn't have a job in 1996. I began teaching at university and consulting. And finally, about 2005, I resurrected Cooper's Moon again and began rewriting. And in 2010, I actually got an agent. So he tried shopping my books. completed three of those and wasn't successful in shopping my books. Tristram Coburn of Tristram Coburn Literary Agency. And so we agreed that I should probably try it as an independent writer.
So you wrote these books. You had mm-hmm. these things that you created. You
yes.
slaved over, cried,
oh,
laughed a little maybe sometimes.
Oh, yes.
And then you have an agent, and so it's mm-hmm. his job to try to – this is how publishing – traditional publishing works.
Right.
You have this
yeah.
agent, and he tries to interest publishing mm-hmm. houses in putting up the money
yes.
to publish this, to put it on paper and
right.
to distribute it and get it out into the world and maybe
yes.
put some marketing behind it. That's how it – traditionally the old school way.
That's right.
But you kind of struck out on your own and decided to self-publish. How was that different?
Well, you know, it's different in the sense that a lot more work falls on the shoulders of the self-published writer. We like to say indie writers anymore. A lot of my friends who have been traditionally published writers have now gone the indie route. We call it independent publishing.
I think indie film, when you say indie, is it kind of comparable?
Yeah. Thank you for asking that question. Yes, I think that's the best analogy. Indie publishing is no different really than indie films or indie music. It seems like the whole market has sort of turned on its head. Indie music has now turned into iTunes and Apple. You know, indie film has turned into things like Sundance and all those film. Those places where you shop your indie films.
The film festivals,
film
usually,
festivals.
Right?
Thanks for that yeah. for that word. Yes. My son is an independent filmmaker, teaches at the university now in Maryland, and he and his friends are still making indie films. One of their indie films opened at the Grauman Theater in Los Angeles, famous old Grauman Theater.
So the apple didn't fall far from the tree with the independent streak. What kind of responsibilities end up falling on the independent writer when they decide to self-publish? What kind of things are you talking about, like marketing and distributing? And how do you get your you have your book. I'm looking at it here.
Yeah.
How do you get that on the shelf at Barnes & Noble, for example? Do you do that or do you have to go with smaller ones, smaller bookstores?
No. It is available at Barnes & Noble. It's interesting question, Julie. The things that really fall on our shoulders, I notice the most, is the editing. But I have a wife who is Karen, who's a former managing editor of a national magazine.
That helps.
So she's a cruel but loving critic. And my former agent who's still working with me was a very cruel and loving critic as well. So I had those two editorial reviews of my books, fortunately, before I even tried to put it out in the market. So editing is a major one. I'd say the second one would be marketing. But I've got to tell you that and I don't mean this to be a criticism of the large traditional publishing houses, but many of my friends who have been and are New York Times bestselling writers have said that the big publishing houses, the big five, don't do anything for the little guys. They work with the big people. They don't have the time or the money. I think they're having trouble financially to do that. So therefore, marketing falls on the shoulder of the traditionally published writer, unless you're Stephen King.
Yeah, or James Patterson or one of these. Yeah, right.
Or James, who is a corporation all itself.
Yeah, that's an entire economy, I think it is, actually. So with a lack of – there aren't that many small bookstores around anymore. There are a few. They're starting to come back.
They are, yes.
But there's not a whole lot of them. So how do you get your books on the shelf? Do you walk into retailers and just say, hey, I wrote this book. Could you put it on your shelf right here?
I haven't done that yet.
Can I pay you for some shelf space here? How does that work?
Well, interestingly enough, a couple of great independent bookstores here, McIntosh Books on Sanibel Island and Murder on the Beach Bookstore, we're doing a signing at both of those places, are very successful. And it seems, Julie, that the independent bookstores are coming back while, God rest its soul, Barnes & Noble is having trouble surviving in this market of Amazon and the internet. And so it's not that hard. I think it takes a marketer like my wife, which most independent authors don't have, to really be able to get your books on the bookshelves. But yes, they're on the bookshelves of both of those stores now. And we'll be doing signings at other independent bookstores as well.
You kind of got to hustle and get behind it, though.
To hustle. And you have to hustle even if you're a traditionally published writer.
You'd have to do it either way.
Oh, my,
But the
yes.
take on it, though, is 100% yours.
Yes.
As opposed to having to share it with a publisher.
Yes. And the other dreadful story that people tell about traditional publishing is that your first 3 months are your life and death story. That either sells within the first 3 months or it doesn't. And then you're kind of in difficulty with your publisher. And I can see why. The publisher doesn't want to invest a lot of money in an author who's not selling. Whereas in the indie publishing market, it's the other way around. It's a slow kind of – how can I put it? It's a slow line upwards. It's not fast.
I'm thinking of like a low and slow roast instead of microwaving a burrito. That's where my mind goes.
That's a beautiful way to put it. There's a great story by a young writer, a lawyer in New York. Her name is Darcy Chan, and she wrote a book about the widow of Salt Fork. I don't know if I'm quoting her book title exactly, but she went through the same thing. She had one of the best agents in New York, and she came to an agreement with her agent that it was a fine book. She should try selling it herself. And so she began to do that. And for the first year, she didn't have much luck. Her husband was a doctor, so he had kind of enough money to keep them going. And she was working with the Senate, still is, I think. But after a year, and her use of the social media, and I think that's the key, Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and Pinterest and some of the others, she began to slowly build her audience. And it's there where the independent author has to turn for most of their marketing. And she went from very little to, I believe it was either 1,000 books a day or 1,000 a week, until she's now sold about 800,000. That was as of a year or so ago.
So if you sold 800,000 books.
Wow.
What do you end up getting out of that? So, I mean, if you sell 800,000 books, mm-hmm. you have to pay for the paper, I imagine, to print it on.
You pay for the printing, yes.
But if you charge $10 a book, I'm just going to use mm-hmm. simple math, then 800,000 times 10 is just not bad.
No. For a paperback, you probably should charge about 14 something for a paperback. You can make probably $3 a book. With a traditional publisher, you probably make 87 cents. With Kindle, I think you get about 70% royalty from Kindle. I say I think about because I'm still trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
But it's of $2.99, it would be about 70%, would be about $2 a book, a Kindle book. And with a traditional publisher, it wouldn't even be close to that. So you have to sell about 10 times the number of books with a traditional publisher to make what you would make 10 times the number of books to make what you would make in self-publishing.
I think it's interesting the notion of there's some professions where people just kind of think they can, because people mm-hmm. can write sentences and they can construct mm-hmm. paragraphs.
Yes.
But tell me a little bit more about the writing process. Like, how
yes.
do you write? That's a lot of attention span to hang on for a whole book.
It is. And that's a great question again, Julie, and I know you love hearing that's a great question because that's what you do. But anyway, I grew up in a writing family. My father was the poet laureate of Southern Ohio, called the Steubenville Diocese. They named him that. He published in traditional venues. He won a contest and published a short story in This Week magazine. And my mother was the same way. So we would spend nights reading poetry to each other, and it was a game. Who could guess what poet wrote what lines? So I learned to write that way by listening to poetry and reading the classics. And then I learned from a professor of mine at seminary that writing is a bloody process.
It's solitary. It's very lonely.
Oh, my. It is. Yes. You write deep into the night or early in the morning.
Because that's the only time you can get your thoughts clear enough to actually write. I guess it depends on the person. Some people can write in the middle of a busy coffee shop.
Yeah, they can. I can't do that.
Neither
Randy Wayne White writes in a busy place.
Well,
can't
your
do that.
Book, let's make a pivot now. Your book has been compared to Randy Wainwright books in that they take place, this one here, that takes
yes.
place in Florida. A lot mm-hmm. of activity, a lot of intrigue.
Oh, yeah.
Very detailed information about,
yes, thanks.
It's really interesting. Tell me just a little bit about it before we run out of time. We only have a little bit of time left, but tell me
okay.
a bit about it.
Well, Cooper's Moon is really about a philosophy teacher who was teaching one morning in late August at the beginning of the school year, and his dean comes to his room, knocks on the door and says, "You need to get home." And Cooper says, "Why?" And he says, "Your son is missing. He thinks he's missing or been killed." Missing, and your wife needs you. So the prologue really begins that whole story with Cooper dashing across the field, going to his home, hoping his son will appear suddenly, a 7-year-old son, and he doesn't. And so the story of Cooper's Moon is about this philosophy professor and his wife who fight for a year about who is responsible, because that's kind of what happens, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Who's responsible for that? And he goes to Miami following a clue. After he leaves his wife, they don't divorce, they get separated, and he becomes a cop with the Miami Police Department, kind of a strange transition, does that for a couple of years, and then becomes a homicide detective. And Cooper's Moon begins at that point.
Where Cooper, he's a homicide detective. He just
yes.
left behind the teaching, and he's on this
right.
quest to try to find his son.
Yes, and each book deals with that quest. The first book deals with trafficking, a major problem, because Florida is one of the major states involved in the trafficking business, either as a receiver. The U.S., by the way, is the number one destination point for human trafficking.
Southwest Florida is a hot spot for it, too. We've done shows on that here. We've talked about it before.
Yeah.
So that you have this book is out, and then do you have two more behind it ready to be published?
Yes, they're all done. Blood Moon Rising should come out in November, and that's kind of a follow-up to Cooper's Moon, the same quest. This one deals with Russians who are involved in the sale of body parts. Mostly takes place in the Gulf, which is why I was fascinated with your previous guest discussion of
the Gulf. Yeah, it is interesting.
And book three continues the search, and finally the disappearance of his son is resolved for good or ill, but I can't tell you because I'd have to kill him.
Spoiler alert. All right, well, that's all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank my guest, Richard Conrath. He's the author of Cooper's Moon, which is available on Amazon and other places that you find books. The next book in the series is due to be released later this year. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Julie.
Our show today was produced by Mike Inirie. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1 WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.